From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, transferring money, line item vetoes. Governor Whitmer retools the state's new budget, and we'll get an update from Lansing. Plus, the rural school district that could be the first in Michigan to let staff carry guns into classrooms because they're so far away from the closest police stations.
Anywhere from 13 to 35 minutes. That's not acceptable in a school shooting, especially when research says it's over in 7 minutes.
Aerial spraying for mosquitoes, the state's response to the ongoing outbreak of eastern equine encephalitis, a dangerous, incurable disease carried by mosquitoes.
We know that there's not a hard frost planned anytime soon, which is what it takes to kill off the mosquitoes. So we know that there is still a danger to Michigan residents.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why the superintendent of a rural Michigan school district is considering letting school staffers carry guns.
My district consists of three counties, with each sheriff department at least 25 or more miles away.
We'll have that story later in the hour. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer unveiled a mountain of line item vetoes she made to the state budget sent to her by GOP leaders in the legislature. Here is the governor today.
I did what I said I was going to do.
So what did Governor Whitmer say she was going to do that was reflected in her cuts, her slashes, and the shifting of money? Here to help us understand what the governor approved or rejected is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief with the Michigan Public Radio Network, and Emily Lawler, political reporter with MLive. I want to start by reminding everybody just how the governor is able to retool this $59.9 billion budget that the GOP passed, the one she called a mess, into something more to her liking. Then we walk through the winners and losers in all of this. So, Rick Pluta, first things first, the governor did sign the 16 budgets?
She did, although she did some saber-rattling in advance. Right, Emily? That you know, that maybe she wouldn't.
Yes, I do believe there was that saber-rattling.
Yeah, she, and I don't know if it's a record, but it's a lot, 147 line items.
Yeah.
And then she used this administrative power, it's kind of unique to the governor of Michigan, to move money around inside budgets. She can't move them from one department budget to another, but she could move them around inside these budgets, and that was just a little bit south of $600 million.
And how much did the line item vetoes, those 147 line item vetoes, what did that total, Emily?
Those are $947 million, so almost $1 billion in those line item vetoes.
Is that number of line item vetoes, is that higher than usual or par for the course? How does it rank with other years?
It's a lot of line item vetoes.
It definitely is.
But remember, too, that for the past 8 years, we've had a Republican governor, we've had a Republican House, we've had a Republican Senate. So this stuff typically got negotiated in advance. Now we've got a Democratic governor, a Republican House, a Republican Senate. And so let's just say that the process has not been quite as harmonious as what we've been used to of late.
So when you talk about these interdepartmental budget transfers that I know you explained to us yesterday, Rick, these date back to the John Engler era, talk about the line item vetoes. So who gets to do what with all of that money, Emily?
You know, obviously, this is funding state departments starting today, actually, for this fiscal year. So state departments have to look at this final product, which is kind of a mishmash of what the legislature put in and then what Whitmer eliminated and moved, and decide how to go from there. But there are concerns that actually some of this money isn't enough for some state departments to maintain the things they have been doing. Department of Technology Management and Budget and Corrections Department are expecting that maybe even some layoffs could come of this. So departments have to figure out how to operate within this constraint now.
All right, let's talk about the line item vetoes. Rick Pluta, what are some of the big items that Governor Whitmer, you know, crossed off, got rid of in this GOP-crafted budget? Who are some of the major winners and losers in the line item vetoes?
Well, you know, I'd kind of like to focus on one because I thought this was interesting, that she line itemed the Pure Michigan travel program, the one that advocates for sells traveling in Michigan,
yeah,
and a lot of tourism takes place in districts that are represented by Republicans, and they like that. And the reason it's fascinating is, first of all, everyone knows it. But the other thing, too, is I think it speaks to what a lot of these budget machinations are really about, which is getting Republican leadership back to the table and trying to bargain, you know, what I would call budget 2.0.
So get us back. Go ahead, Emily. What do you want to add?
One more big one I'd throw in there is some stuff out of the transportation budget. Governor has been really clear that she's seeking a holistic, long-term roads plan. It's part of what derailed these budget talks. And, you know, the Republicans had included some one-time road funding, and she struck a lot of that out. You know, she's still looking for that bigger solution.
Yeah,
that permanent solution, that tax increase that's been anathema to Republicans today.
So basically, she wiped out that $375 million that the lawmakers pieced together from those other department budgets to prove, yes, we can fix the roads and not have to raise taxes. And she's like, we're going to talk.
You got
That's not going to work, yeah.
There were some other things that were slashed that seemed to perhaps be designed to create pain points for GOP lawmakers. Did we see any of that in these budget shifts, Emily?
Absolutely. Well, as in terms of the shift specifically, I think she got in a little dig on the PowerPoint presentation. She put in a lot of money in the DHHS budget, did some
Department
shifts.
Of Health and Human Services.
did some shifts to make sure that they could properly fund Medicaid work requirements, which are a new legislative requirement coming online, coming up here. And in moving part of that around, she mentioned that she took some budget line items from more specific areas. One to the Van Andel Institute and put it toward that
cause. One stuck out at me. Very Grand Rapids, West
yes.
Michigan. And of course, you know, Jay Van Andel
yes.
is kind of a Republican icon.
That was $9 million.
Yeah.
It was earmarked.
Yeah.
So it was like, no, it's going to help people meet those Medicaid work requirements. So that was quite the shot across the bow. She also took, like $90.9 million from 43 items in Attorney General Nessel's budget and put them into her department's base operating funds. Is that the idea? I'm going to give the Attorney General more latitude in how she's going to use that funding?
I think that is the idea. And there were some concerns from the Attorney General's end on just her department being so segmented. I think she called it an administrative nightmare, perhaps, or something,
well,
something
remember,
along those
too,
lines.
Republicans were wanting to create these conditions, these parameters around which the Attorney General could operate, that she would have to get legislative permission before filing some types of lawsuits and stuff like that. So, just a lot of partisan rivalries being set up in this budget,
like a budget chess game. So here's the big question of these line item vetoes. These 147 line item vetoes have been unveiled. The interdepartmental budget transfers have been unveiled. What's been the Republican response to these budget maneuvers, Rick?
Well, mostly silence, but the governor has said that she wants to convene a meeting of what's called the quadrant, which are the House Republican and Democratic leaders, the Senate Republican and Democratic leaders, to try and restart these budget negotiations. Senate Majority Leader Republican Mike Shirky has said that he's ready to show up, but we haven't heard from any of the of the other leaders yet.
And Senate Majority Leader Shirky also said he didn't want to get involved in a tug of war. So I'm sort of wondering, obviously the question is, she's set the table for sort of a new negotiation, pushing through a supplemental, talking about which of these vetoes stay and which Republicans might be able to bargain back for. But the question is if Republicans are really, game for that at this point.
So certainly from what you're telling us and the story you're painting, there was, when you think of the political calculus that we can glean from Governor Whitmer's budget decisions, she wasn't just moving money into her priority, but she wanted the Republicans to feel that. I mean, slashing funding for charter schools and college scholarships. And as you say, Rick, pure Michigan. I mean, when you think that Lee Chatfield's district includes Mackinac Island and the House floor leader has Torch Lake and Boyne Mountain. So
Well, but here's the big question is that so far what we've been hearing from Republican leaders, Emily, I'd say for the last 48 or for the last 24 hours on this, has been it's just no go on a lot of the governor's major priorities. And even if the Republican leaders were on board, and Cindy, I know that you are a big fan of the musical Hamilton.
I am.
And, what the refrain is when Hamilton comes in with, his financial plan, mm-hmm. and he's told, you don't have the votes, you don't have the votes, I will sing it for you. Yeah. And that's kind of the position that she's in. Even if she gets buy-in from the leaders, can she get buy-in from the Republican caucuses?
So that has to be figured out. And then meantime, for Emily, you alluded to this, for Whitmer's department heads, has it been kind of a head-spinning day?
A lot of them came to the administrative board meeting this morning and her press conference afterward, and I did get a chance to catch up with some, including the Department of Corrections director. This is a big change, and it's handed down basically day of. I'm assuming they got a little bit more of a heads up than perhaps the public, legislature, and media because the vetoes were signed last night but not released until this morning. But yeah, departments have a lot to deal with, and they have a lot to deal with right now.
With no certainty that this is going to be the final result, as this stuff may get rebargained as the Republicans and the governor start talking again.
This could be the never-ending budget cycle.
How much of this is the governor saying to the legislature, hey, thanks for getting me the budget 84 hours before the constitutional deadline for me to sign or veto these budget bills?
Gee, did that come up, Emily?
She might have mentioned the number 84.
Yeah, I think it might have come up. Yeah. Once or twice. Yeah.
So what have we learned through all of this about the way that this governor and this legislature will be working together going forward?
You know, nobody's afraid here. The governor was very clear that she wanted to, that she did these, kind of drastic measures, or not drastic, I'm sorry, but, these unusual measures, perhaps, and that she felt like they were necessary because of the budget that she got. And at the same time, the legislature, when the governor wasn't negotiating with them anymore, which she says was never a negotiation, by the way, because they were giving ultimatums, the governor wasn't afraid to say, send me the budget. And then she wasn't afraid to do what she did after that. So I think that they're kind of setting up a real head-to-head here.
It seems to me like the governor is trying to figure out how to play an effective version of hardball with a legislature that seems willing to stand its ground.
Well, there we go. And Rick Pluta, nice job working cabinet battle number one from Hamilton into today's conversation. Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief. Emily Lawler from MLive. Thank you so much to our Lansing team. And coming up, we will meet the U of M philosopher and newly awarded MacArthur genius.
One way to think about philosophers is we're like kids, you never grew up. We always ask why.
We'll reflect on philosophy's relevance for life in the modern age. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time to listen to some new music from West Michigan. Journalist and critic John Sinkovich of LocalSpins.com is here, all excited about the latest album from a veteran singer-songwriter, someone that we have heard a lot here on Stateside. John, take it away. I know you're excited about this album.
Yeah, there's never been anyone quite like Michigan's Mae Erlewine, and she continues to push that envelope and advance her music in a unique way. This one in particular really pushes sort of the political activist side of her personality and what she really wants to do. And the thing that I think is amazing that she's so brilliant at bridging that sort of separation and dichotomy between standing up for what she thinks is right and then serving as sort of a calming, healing influence.
Looking for a reason why you do the things you do. You tell me right into you do.
And this album is all about that. As an activist, she kind of views this as, and she says it's, quote, an emotional fuel for activists to continue their work and remember that it's really important to stay engaged. And yet at the same time, it's a pretty tranquil album at times and other times very passionate.
That's my future, dancing on a wire.
John, you saw May perform some of this new material from Second Sight at Earthwork Harvest Gathering recently. Tell us, how did fans receive this material?
It was fairly incredible. She always has a wonderful connection with her fans in the audience when she's performing live, but she's with this super group of a band, and she introduces the song with talking about how, you know, it's coming together as a community and how we have to stand up. And there were people literally in tears by the end of this performance, and it was a jam-packed stage that she had that night. It was, you know, she had a new feminist anthem that she kind of revealed that night as well, that's part of this new album. She really has a way of connecting with an audience unlike almost any other performer.
Well, I have to say, that's my home. I just thought it's a splendid song, and it has great production.
Yeah, it does. And she's got several album release shows coming up this week. She's going to be playing in Lake Orion on Thursday, at the Ark in Ann Arbor on Friday, at Bell's Eccentric Cafe in Kalamazoo on Saturday, and then finally October 6th, Sunday, at Wealthy Theater right here in Grand Rapids. She's got a great band behind her as well.
All right, so now from the iconic May Erlewine to a debut album from a young up-and-coming singer-songwriter, Patty Pershala. Now, you call her definitely one of West Michigan's emerging artists to watch. Why do you say that?
She's absolutely refreshing. She's a multi-instrumentalist. She can garage rock with the best of them, and yet at the same time, she can do this ukulele-based kind of folk punk, folk kind of a thing that really sort of speaks to her very unique songwriting. And I think the song that is the title track from her new EP called Oracle Bones shows that off. She really has a wonderful style about her.
Your bones.
I love the way you say she describes her solo shows as peace, love, and a giant crowbar.
Yeah, she does ukulele versions of heavy metal tunes, for instance. She also, interestingly enough, she was in a band called Earth Radio, but she also is in a Rush tribute band. So you think about the sort of the dichotomy of that and how interesting it is that she can able to do so many versatile things with her music. And this particular album was inspired, sort of a Halloween-inspired collection. It's got a song on it called The Horror, and she says that the song was influenced by Alice Cooper and Edgar Allan Poe.
I love it. So this is Oracle Bones, this new EP from Patty Pershala. Is she performing around to kind of push this?
She'll be playing in Grand Rapids at Tip Top Deluxe Bar and Grill on Wednesday night this week. And then on Saturday, October 5, she'll also be one of several performers that'll be playing at Founders Brewing's 2019 Harvest Party here in Grand Rapids.
All right. And now we head to the Skinny Limbs out of Grand Rapids. Tell us about this band.
Well, the Skinny Limbs are interesting because they kind of started out as sort of this sunny Lake Michigan-inspired pop band, you know, very beachy, dreamy milieu with their music. Guitars had a lot of surf rock reverb to it. But on their second EP, and this is titled Seafarer, the group has kind of pushed its sound out a bit. It's more unique and more of an alt-indie rock sound. There's still that kind of lightness to their pop songs, but I think it's more mature, and as they put it, it has more emotional depth. They're talking about love and longing and sort of disheartening social trends are some of the subject matter on this album. But I can tell you that it has a very enticing and engaging national kind of pop sound to it.
I know that I'm so sick of being the second.
This is actually a band of brothers, I understand.
Yeah, Max, Jake, and Nate Knoth, and then Connor and Gavin O'Brien. They're a fun bunch. It's nicely arranged pop music, and they're not currently performing anywhere. They released this record in a September performance at the Pyramid Scheme. They're concentrating on building their audience, but I know they're going to be out there performing again soon.
Well, some really good offerings. So just to recap what we've talked about, the Skinny Limbs and their six-song sophomore EP, Seafarer. Patty Pershala, her debut six-song EP is Oracle Bones. And May Erlewine with her new album, Second Sight. You can learn all about these and other artists. Just go to localspins.com, edited and published by John Sinkovich. Great bunch of songs this time around, John. As always, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you. Have a great week.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Becoming a MacArthur Fellow, it's a pretty big deal. For one thing, a lot of people call it the Genius Grant. You can't apply, you have to be nominated. This fellowship brings a $625,000 no-strings-attached award. And among the recently announced 2019 class of MacArthur Fellows is University of Michigan philosopher Elizabeth Anderson, and she's here with us now. Professor Anderson, congratulations and welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Did you have any idea that this was in the works and you were going to win this honor and this grant?
Absolutely not. No, they keep a very tight wrap on everything. I was sitting in my desk at home. I work from home. Got a call out of the blue. They said, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "Yes." Then they asked, "Are you completely alone?" And I was. And then they had it on speakerphone so that everybody who had been involved in the nomination in the MacArthur Foundation could hear my response when they told me. Of course, I was totally floored.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
What did you feel at that
moment? Well, I was just completely amazed and overwhelmed. I mean, obviously, it's not the kind of thing you can expect.
Do you have any idea who nominated you?
No, they keep everything under wraps.
So somewhere out there, you could be seeing them each day, but at this point, you don't know who it was who
nominated
you.
I'm very grateful, whoever it is.
So tell us about your work, particularly your special areas of interest.
Right. So I'm a philosopher, and my signature method is to be extremely interdisciplinary. So I read across the social sciences, history, women's studies. And I start from what the other disciplines are saying and look for problems that they're identifying. And then I reflect on those problems rather than working entirely internally to the discipline of philosophy.
Which is, you know, this is a really good chance to ask a philosopher. We hear about philosophy. It's an ancient science that goes so far back. But what is philosophy? What do you think it is?
So philosophy asks some fundamental questions about the nature of our world and also about our moral obligations and what is the good, what's justice, but also things like what is the nature of causation, what are laws of nature. So we have metaphysical questions, we have moral and political questions. We also have questions about knowledge, like how do I know anything? By what methods can we acquire knowledge? So we ask really fundamental questions like that. One way to think about philosophers is we're like kids who never grew up. We always ask why. It's like curiosity and we're never satisfied with the answers, but we get deeper and deeper understanding of the terrain by asking these questions.
And what drew you to this field?
I was originally, as an undergraduate, going to major in economics. But when I was reading economics, I saw that it was making all kinds of assumptions that I thought, well, maybe we should question those assumptions.
Like, going back to the kid, why?
Exactly, yeah. Like, why should we assume that just because somebody chose something that it would improve their welfare? Well, you know, people sometimes make self-destructive decisions. And those questions lead you naturally to philosophy.
And I know your research has dug into democratic theory and equality in political philosophy. What insights can you offer to a country where so many people feel left behind and that the system and all the goodies have passed them by?
Well, that's a fantastic question. So a lot of my research is starting from those concerns, and I've been exploring different ways in which those concerns emerge. One of them is in the workplace. My latest book called Private Government, How Employers Rule Us and Why We Don't Talk About It, is about the experience of workers being ruled by their bosses, not only while they're at work, but even off duty.
And we can thank technology for that.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of surveillance, exactly, and employers keep tabs on people. Workers can be fired for expressing political opinions that their employer disagrees with. There's all kinds of control. In many states, workers can be fired because they married a same-sex partner. So these seem to be private decisions that they should have all to themselves, and employers are basically taking a hand in it and imposing serious costs. And so my book is about that, but it's starting from the problematic experiences that workers have. And then I'm thinking in a larger terms about, okay, this is a problem. And how should we understand this problem? And my argument is we should understand it as a form of what I call private government, which is to say government which is held privately by the rulers, from which the governed are kept out. And we think that kind of government is wrong for the state, so why should it be okay for the employment relation? Workers ought to have a voice. Now, we do have a long tradition of labor unions where workers do get a voice, but as you know, in Michigan, as well as really across the country, labor unions have been in decline. So I'm thinking about alternative ways of governing the workplace so workers can have a voice.
Elizabeth, do you encounter situations where a student may say, you know what, I'm really taken with this. I want to major in philosophy. And then you have a tuition-paying parent who is less than enthusiastic and wondering, how employable would you be with your philosophy degree? What do you say to those students and parents?
The College of Literature, Sciences, and Arts has a wonderful tool. They have a giant wheel online, and for each major, it shows what careers people with that major end up taking. And it turns out that philosophers end up everywhere. They enter all the professions. They go into business. They go into finance. Really, being a philosophy major actually opens up opportunities because businesses like to hire people who have tackled difficult problems, mastered writing skills, have really serious analytical abilities. They're looking for generalists, and generalists then can hop in and handle all kinds of challenges that are thrown at them.
They know how to think.
Exactly.
They know how to think, and they're nimble.
Yeah.
All right. So tell me, with this $625,000 grant that you'll be getting over the next 5 years, what will that let you do? How will this affect your work?
Primarily, I'm going to be taking research leave because I have a lot of books to write. So that'll be my main thing. I'll be buying out some time.
It's known as the Genius Grant. Do you feel like a genius?
So as a philosopher who's also a woman, I want to take exception to this notion of geniuses. There was actually a study done that showed that the ratio of women in any discipline is directly negatively correlated to people's beliefs about whether you need to be a genius to practice that discipline. And philosophy is off the charts, and people thinking, oh, this is such a hard thing, only geniuses can do it. And philosophy also has far fewer women than any other discipline in the liberal arts except for physics. I think physics and philosophy basically have roughly the same percentage of women.
Which and is very, very
because
modest.
Because people think also you got to be a genius to be a physicist, whereas women are strongly represented in other fields such as biology and psychology and literature and so forth. But in fact, I think this is just a complete myth. And even at the very founding of philosophy, we go back to the 5th century BC in ancient Greece. One of the earliest philosophers was Plato, and his hero was Socrates, another famous Greek philosopher. Plato wrote a bunch of dialogues where Socrates is encountering various Athenians and starting up philosophical conversations with them. And Socrates struck up a philosophical conversation with a slave boy. I think Plato's sending a message here that, in fact, philosophy's for everyone. And that gets back to my original point, which is that philosophers basically never stop asking why. We're just like kids in that way. And I want to write for the public to show that anybody can pick up a work of philosophy and reflect on it and put in their own two cents.
Professor Elizabeth Anderson of the University of Michigan, a philosopher who's among the recently announced 2019 class of MacArthur Fellows. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Still to come, the state has moved ahead with the first aerial insecticide spraying in Michigan since 1980. We'll talk about the effort to curb the spread of eastern equine encephalitis. That comes up later, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When a school is thrust into an active shooter situation, every single second counts, which is why the safety concerns of urban school administrators are very different from those of rural school administrators. When you're miles away from the closest police station, seconds quickly turn into minutes, and that could be deadly. Which is why Addison Community Schools could become the first district in Michigan to allow staff to carry guns. Steve Guerra is here. He's the superintendent of Addison Community Schools. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
So, first of all, help us understand exactly where the schools are located.
We are on the far western side of Lenawee County and the far eastern side of Hillsdale County and the far southern side of Jackson County. So, my district consists of three counties. So, with each sheriff department at least 25 or more miles away.
That was my next question then. So the nearest police agency, you're talking 25 some miles?
Well, Hudson is about 10 miles south, and they have their own police department, but I'm talking the sheriff departments. Even the state troopers are the same distance.
So time-wise, that would be?
Time-wise, and that's been our concern. The last couple years, we've had some additional lockdowns where we've had threats in our bathroom walls, you know, that I have a gun and we're going to kill everybody at 1 o'clock. So we do the 911 call in anywhere from 13 to 35 minutes. That's not acceptable in a school shooting, especially when research says it's over in 7 minutes. 35 minutes, they would have wiped out my entire population. So that's why we've talked about it about a year and a half ago, and I don't want to jump into it.
Sure.
About a year and a half ago, we had a forum, and we were just brainstorming ideas of how can we get better security in our school district. We talked about metal detectors. We talked about resource officers, bulletproof windows, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, there were some people in the audience that said, hey, what about arming your employees? There's other states. And as a matter of fact, there's 20 states. We are only 20 miles from the Ohio border, which is the second largest behind Texas.
So we know here in the Great Lakes region it's being done.
Yeah, it's being done. And matter of fact, we got a lot of our information as we researched it from Ohio. From there, our board formed a new committee, a safety committee. And that's three board members and myself is the makeup of the committee. And we started talking and researching, could we do this? Then finally we decided on September 9th, let's have this open forum. And 100 and some people showed up.
And that was open to the community.
It was open to the community. Yeah. Yes, we got people from outside our community that came in and gave us their opinion on whether they're for or against it. Mm-hmm. But I was pleased with the turnout. So now, today at 4 o'clock, our safety committee reconvenes to say, all right, where do we go now?
So this has been a process. Certainly, you've taken time. You're talking about over a year's worth of study. And you also had taken safety steps and upgraded equipment at schools.
Last year, I received a Michigan State Police Safety Grant, $48,000. So I have now shatterproof window film in 192 windows. I added an additional camera. We added a security system to our secondary, so now they buzz into the office, and we're in the process of doing the same thing in the elementary, where they funnel right to the office rather than going into the hallway. So we have, many things in place already, but
you keep thinking of that time.
I keep thinking of the time, and I have people on staff that are willing to do this.
And that was my next question. What's the process? So how do you decide who will carry and who won't?
As our safety committee talked about this, we're not satisfied. I'm not satisfied, and I sort of led the way, is that to get a CPL, it's an eight-hour training. You fire 100 shots, and you take a multiple-choice test, and you get your license for 5 years. We're not satisfied with that. We want an advanced training. We also want, because of our rural district, I want training in my school building. I want the state police as well as the Lenawee Sheriff involved to show us how to potentially navigate down a hallway if we have an active shooter.
Real world is a lot different.
Let's get real. The nice thing about our building is we're K-12, we're all under one roof. So we're connected by a hallway. So the training inside is vital. And the last piece, which is probably the most important, is the psychological. We want to make sure that whoever is carrying, that they're in the state of mind, that they're okay with potentially taking somebody's life. I don't want anybody that's nervous. I mean, I'm sort of the old school where, I have a CPL, so I'm confident at what I do, and if I have to do that, I'm old school Italian that hit first, ask questions later, and anybody that has this, they've got to have that same mindset to come right out of the classroom or office, and it's not negotiation time.
No. Have you had staff who said, yep, I'm in?
Yep, I have eight on staff.
For how many students?
812. We're a small district. Again, I'm not satisfied with what I have. I think there's more that I can do. We've researched resource officers. I've got some quotes on my desk. And again, I don't want to put money in front of safety. But when you're a rural district, and I just lost 18 kids this year, and kids are money.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's a pretty substantial amount. And, now all of a sudden you have to start paying a resource officer. So I don't want to go to my kindergarten, first grade teachers and say, oh, by the way, you now have 32 in your classroom because I got to lay off in order to hire a resource officer. So I got people on staff that are willing to do it. We would pay them a small stipend. Mm-hmm. They're willing to put their neck out on the line for our kids.
And what kind of discussions have you had with the sheriff's departments of these counties?
Well, they're not saying they're against it, but they're sort of taking the neutral. And
what questions do they have?
We had Adrian Police, who is also a parent in our audience, as well as Lenawee Sheriff Lieutenant. And both of them, as long as we had the additional training, they were good. And again, I think if we move forward, those are those conversations, because I want to make sure that all the players outside my building, whether it's the state troopers or the Hudson Police or the Lenawee Sheriff Department, that when they come into the building, they know my players.
Yes.
I don't need somebody to get shot, trying to help. So there's still a lot to do if we move forward. So.
And students and parents, what are you hearing from them?
The students and parents, it was at our forum, it was like a 50-50, the people that spoke. But there were also people there was a gentleman that came from Kalamazoo. And there were some people from Tecumseh and from Adrian that are not really connected to my district. So I was more interested in my district. If I looked at just my district, the majority of them were in favor of it. My Teachers Association president spoke at our meeting, and he indicated that the majority of our teachers are in favor of it.
Because the overall statewide teachers union, not so much.
71%. Mm-hmm. But there's one of those statistics that it doesn't really apply to me. Here, my local district, teachers are saying they're in favor of it.
Right.
I have a new elementary principal just this year, and I think she felt her teachers weren't in favor of it, and she just last week took a poll, 12 in favor, 9 against. So again, I think everybody at this point, they don't really think we should have guns in school, but it's time. I mean, you look around how many in the last year, how many mass shootings have we had? And is it the most optimal way to do it? Probably not. But when I have a hard time being the superintendent of a school and not can't guarantee safety. Could I guarantee if I carried a gun? No, but I feel that I can reduce the casualties. And I think that's the key. And again, it's time. Seconds. If somebody can step out of their classroom or out of their office and take care of the situation, I can't wait 13 or 35 minutes for somebody to arrive.
So you've got a meeting later today, the committee. What would move forward? What would it take to enact this policy and become the first district in Michigan be arming staff?
So we're going to talk at the safety committee. And because it's, I feel that, again, I don't really have a vote because it's board members that sort of do the voting. But I feel because it has been such a high profile conversation in the state, I feel from my safety committee, I should take it to the full board and have the full board decide. Because, the community was somewhat divided in the teachers, even though I say the majority. I think it's a
pretty strong representation of no's.
I think it warrants a full board vote rather than letting this type of issue die in a safety committee with 3 members. And if you know boards, a quorum is 4 votes. So maybe all are against it, but there could be 4 that are totally in favor of it. So not that I want a 4-3 vote on this issue, but I think it warrants going to the full board for a vote.
Finally, Steve, do you feel that other rural districts in Michigan are watching?
Yes. I was at the superintendent conference, and several people looked at me and recognized me like, I seen you. You're that guy that was on the TV. And I said, yeah. So I think even my colleagues in Jackson County says, oh, yeah, now we got to talk about safety. We should be. I mean, we should be. And I think that, will there be more states? I think there'll be more states. You know, we're already at 20. And again, if in the perfect world, every school would have a resource officer, but we know budgets. Governor Whitner just gave us our budget last night, and sure enough, there's still a lot of money that schools should be getting that we're not. So
you're going to feel it.
Yeah.
Well, please keep us posted. Steve Guerra, superintendent of Addison Community Schools, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Can I put a plug out for my radio station, 95.7, The Panther, home of Addison Classic Rock. Thank you.
There you go. You got building future broadcasters. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michigan began aerial spraying of pesticides last night, hoping to combat mosquitoes carrying eastern equine encephalitis. This is a rare, dangerous disease that affects humans and animals. It kills 33% of the people who get it and can leave survivors with lasting neurological damage. There is no cure for Triple E. So far, 9 people have confirmed cases with 3 deaths in Michigan, while 33 animals have confirmed cases. Most of the affected counties are in southwest Michigan. With us now, Lynn Sutphin, who's with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Lynn, if you could walk us through the protocol. I'm wondering, what are the factors that go into a decision to spray so late in the season, and are there specific guidelines the department follows?
Well, this is a very unusual case for us. This is not something we have done in the past, actually, well, since 1980, that we have the state has gone out and sprayed for mosquitoes. So what we have factored into this is the fact that we are continuing to see cases. They're increasing in animals and in geography as far as expanding into additional counties in the state. Also, to factored into that is the fact we are finding these particular mosquitoes that are carrying this disease. They're being trapped in these counties, so we are still finding them as of even yesterday. So we know that they're still here. We know that there's not a hard frost planned anytime soon, which is what it takes to kill off the mosquitoes. so we know that there is still a danger to Michigan residents.
And who was it that made the final decision that the aerial spray was needed?
That would be Dr. Joné Khaldun, our chief medical executive. That was one of the things that her role is to declare this a public health emergency.
Now, the public did have a chance to opt out of the aerial spraying. In fact, enough people around Kalamazoo and Portage did exactly that, to the point where there won't be spraying in those cities. How do you decide whether or not people can opt out like this, particularly considering so many Triple E cases are from that Kalamazoo area? I mean, I guess I'm asking, how do you balance people's individual concerns with protecting the general public?
Under the MDARG rules, they are allowed to opt out of the spraying. It is just part of the option that we, you know, people have in our state. And individuals, you know, have, there are some that have. And when they do, it's not just their property that gets opted out. We have to give them an 1,000 by 1,000 foot area to ensure that their area doesn't get sprayed. So it does affect other areas. But it is an option that they can take. Even though we do feel this is a public health emergency, we have worked very closely with our local health departments, and all of them had the option to opt in, you know, even if they had cases on. So, you know, this is just something we are doing very cooperatively. We feel that this is the best thing we can do to protect the health and safety of our residents, but they do have that option to opt out.
We got an email from a beekeeper in Kalamazoo who opted out, and she wrote us saying that she didn't get advance warning, and when she wrote with questions about long-term effects on pollinators, birds, and other wildlife, she never got any answers. So explain to us, what is this insecticide the state is using, and how does it affect wildlife?
We are using an insecticide called Maris 3.0. It is an EPA-registered insecticide, and it is registered to be used around organic farms. So it is definitely something that can be used, you know, in quite a lot of areas. It can affect bees, and that is one of the reasons that we are making sure people are aware that the spraying is going to occur, and it's also why the spraying is being done at night. Bees are in the hive in the evening, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, we do this then. We've also talked to our health partners in other states, including Massachusetts, and they have been spraying for a while, and one of the things that they have been monitoring is their honeybee colonies. And they have had a spraying program for about 2 months, and they've talked to and monitored approximately 600 honeybee colonies since it began, and they have not observed any problems from spraying. So that is definitely something we took into consideration. We also made sure that they were aware that if they wanted to take extra precautions, that they could cover the hives. So, you know, those are some of the information we put out. It's in our FAQs that are on our website, michigan.gov/EEE.
Will the state be doing any of that kind of follow-up like you described from Massachusetts, monitoring unintended effects on, you know, bees or monarch butterflies?
Yes, we will be working with our local health departments to conduct surveillance on that.
So, Lynn, where did they spray last night?
They were able to complete spraying in St. Joseph County in two different zones. They did do some spraying in Van Buren and in Cass. But those areas were not completed, so they will be on tonight's list as well. However, we did complete 128,000 acres last night.
And what other areas are on schedule for being sprayed?
Well, we will go back into the areas that weren't completed in Cass and Berrien and Van Buren. And there's a few other areas that are being considered due to the fact that we may have some weather tonight. So they are looking at some other areas in the northern area, like in Montcalm and Newaygo and possibly Lapeer tonight. Those will be kind of alternates. All of that information is going to be updated on our website, michigan.gov/EEE, and that should be up sometime this afternoon.
What's the most important thing you hope the public understands about this aerial spraying effort?
First of all, that there are no expected health effects to either people or your animals, and that if you do want to take extra precautions, which aren't required, but if you are concerned, the simple thing you can do is stay indoors during the spraying time, which doesn't start till about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night and runs till 4 in the morning. And the other thing is that the reason we are doing this is because we feel this is the best option for Michigan right now to protect the health and safety of Michigan residents.
Lynn Sutphin with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Lynn, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's Stateside, U.S. Representatives Debbie Dingell and Fred Upton, the Democrat and the Republican. Together, they say our nation's on a dangerous path toward incivility, that we need to take a collective deep breath and stop demonizing one another. What is the path forward? We'll ask Upton and Dingell next time on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.